Before the existence of written records, humans systematized combat. From prehistory and into the modern day, martial arts have been a part of the fabric of culture and civilization. Whether as a means of self-protection, or to wage war, or to compete, or to preserve a tradition, or to trudge personal greatness, these codified methods push us to ask questions, to explore, to express, to test, and to tell stories. This is Jamie Club's podcast, the official podcast of Club Chimera Martial Art, where we take the path of the vagabond warrior to find knowledge and inspiration from people, events, and ideas. If you are interested in where to follow Jamie Club and Club Chimera products and services, please wait until the end of the show. In the meantime, if you think this product is worth the price of a cup of coffee, please click on Support the Show in this episode's show notes.
Hello and welcome to the Jamie Club Podcast Halloween Edition. Before we proceed with this year's annual special show, I wish to issue the customary trigger warning. Some of the material mentioned in this particular episode is of an especially graphic nature. We will be referencing some horrendous crimes and punishments from history that might be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is strongly advised. The Ballad of Igor. Chapter 1. An Evil and Misshapen Retainer. On the 7th of January, 1611, Janusz Juruweri, known to all as Fiksko, was beheaded in Bicta, then part of the Kingdom of Hungary and now modern Slovakia. This was in accordance with the sentence handed out that day. He lived in a very brutal time where justice was swift. Those tried were not defended in court. Fiksko and his accused fellow accomplices had all only just been arrested on a frozen night on the 29th of December. He had been separated from the other three defendants, Ilona Jo, Doricha Sandash, known to all as Dorko, and Katalin Benicki, and kept in a private cell at the castle Bicta. In accordance with the laws of the time, their confessions had been extracted through two sessions of torture that could have included anything from thumb screws to having matches lit under their fingernails to having their legs crushed. They would have received little sympathy from the public or prosecution, who had no doubt that all had been actively involved in the sadistic torture and murder of between 30 and 650 young girls at Katice Castle. The court would agree on 80 counts, but most suspected more that stretched back over the decades. The four defendants were accused on the basis of some 300 testimonies accumulated over the past year and a complaint made directly to the court of Vienna by a Lutheran minister almost a decade ago. The lady of the castle was really the main defendant, and her name would become the stuff of Gothic nightmares for centuries to come. She was Glofne Eshnerd Bathory Erzsébet, also known as Countess Elizabeth Bathory, and later given such monikers as La Comtesse Sanguinaire, the Blood Countess, and Countess Dracula. If the Guinness Book of Records ain't to go by, she is history's most prolific serial killer. And these were her most trusted servants, who procured these maidens first from the peasantry, an idea apparently first suggested by one Anna Dovolia, conveniently both the cruelest instigator of the tortures and dead since 1609, and then later from the lesser nobles with promises of training in courtly etiquette by the exceptionally educated countess. Once they fell under Erzsébet's care, so the testimonies state, the girls were subjected to a range of tortures, including being pricked regularly by needles, cut with scissors, starved, burned and pierced by red-hot iron tongs, subjected to cannibalistic attacks and forced to bite chunks out of each other, and beaten or frozen to death. An orgy of blood, terror and unimaginable cruelty existed at the castle, in the Countess's other holdings and in transit to them. So terrible were the screams, according to Fiksko's testimony, that neighbouring monks in one of these other off-site locations beat their walls with cups in protest to the noise. So voluminous was the bloodletting that cinders were added to the straw of the girls' sleeping places to soak up the gore. It was only when large numbers of these lesser noble girls did not return from the castle did the complaints reach critical mass, and the Palatine, Dorf or Count Judja Terzo, was tasked by the King of Hungary and future Holy Roman Emperor Matthias II to lead an investigation. Terzo, both the lady's cousin and the man charged with caring for Erzsébet by her now deceased husband, the Black Knight, Count Ferenc Nadezhi, somehow brokered a deal that would allow her to live under house arrest until her death of natural causes in 1614. Erzsébet's story has all the markings of, and many have argued, is the direct inspiration for our ideas about Gothic horror. She was Hungarian, the same nationality as Bela Lugosi, who immortalised the accent we most closely associate with the fictional vampire Count Dracula, thanks to his portrayal in the 1931 Todd Browning movie for Universal Pictures. Her uncle, Istefan Bathory, was Prince of Transylvania, the homeland of the Count and now appropriated by the rest of the world as a land of monsters. This same uncle fought alongside Vlad Tepes, the man who Bram Stoker took his moniker of Dracula, Son of the Dragon, for his titular villain. If all this wasn't enough, she has her own legend that grew up around her crimes, stating that the motivation for them was to bathe in the blood of virgins to reclaim her waning beauty. In 1729, the Jesuit scholar Laszlo Toruski published his Tragica Historia. It is from this work that we first see claims of her bathing in the blood of maidens. There is no contemporary evidence supporting this claim. In 1817, the official records were first made public, but not before the legends, many of which were already being cultivated in an era steeped in superstition and fears of witches and vampires, had taken a firm grip on the imagination. Nevertheless, the tortures she and her conspirators were accused of were terrible enough, and seemed far more motivated by sadistic pleasure than a need to restore youthful appearance. Sorcery was in there too, and on the 24th of January, a final living accomplice, Erzsi Macineri, was burned alive without ceremony or the pretense of a trial. She'd been accused in the testimonies of helping to bake a magic cake to work against the Countess's enemies. Meanwhile, back on the 7th of January, it is ruled that Fitzko's relatively merciful death at the hands of the Axeman was determined by his young age. One might read into that he was therefore naive and impressionable, and the Palatine had decided he was the least culpable of all those who had actually tortured and murdered the girls. Given that his testimony is the most readily quoted, despite being written down in the third person, it's also likely that Terzo wished to reward the youth's eagerness to please, even after two sessions of torture, with a swifter death. He probably would have preferred the fate of Katalin Benetsky, who he claimed never participated in the torture and killing, but only in the burying of the bodies. Katalin further added that she was beaten so severely by the others for feeding the starving victims that she would not leave her bed for a month. For her part, she was not sentenced to death but imprisoned for an indefinite length of time. There is also some implication by her name that she was of a lesser noble birth. There was no actual prison system, so whether she was freed or left to rot is uncertain. The quote-unquote old crones, Ilona and Dorko, suffered the worst. For steeping their fingers in the blood of Christians, it was ordered they would have the same fingers wrenched from their hands with tongs. Then, while still living, they would join Fitzko's decapitated corpse on the fire to be consumed by the flames. Although various other servants and members of the village were also implicated by the defendants, including parents who apparently knowingly gave up their daughters to these terrible fates, no further arrests were made. Justice at the time was something of a ritual, designed to punish, not rehabilitate the guilty, appease the local populace, and deter future criminals, and also to cleanse the local community of the sins. Ilona, Dorko, Fitzko, and Erzsi were all sacrifices in this respect. With their lowly status as common servants, I tend to agree with Tony Thorne's view that Terzo considered them to be expendable, as did the rest of society. He had clearly brokered some kind of deal with the king and members of Erzsébet's family regarding the countess's own sentence. As a self-protection sidebar ahead of my conclusion, it seems very believable that many colluded in the enabling of the countess's crimes. We see such behaviour in society all the time. I'm not arguing there was an organised conspiracy of silence going through the neighbouring villages and hamlets, but rather an uneasy acceptance that something particularly bad was going on with the many girls being sent to be educated at the castle. To what extent the various parents willingly gave up their daughters in the knowledge they would be killed or even suffer fates worse than death is probably a complex psychological issue. We know that there were rumours and complaints, and it appears that what finally resulted in Terzo putting a stop to what was going on. But it's not unbelievable that these crimes crept up on the local community, where it was met with a combination of denial and stoicism as these working people got on with their hard-working days. We have only to look to the various large-scale celebrity scandals where the phrase in plain sight is regularly used to see parallel behaviours. The public are often outraged and thoughts of clandestine conspiracies of silence to protect these public figures come to mind. It's easy to think this way rather than to accept some very uncomfortable facts about human nature. Such figures don't just pop up in show business. They are present in small communities and families, and they're often protected by a groupthink survivalist desire to return life to the status quo. Charismatic and influential predators effectively groom entire families, institutions, communities, and societies by manipulating this survivalist group instinct. In short, it's a lot easier for family gatherings to just tell the youngsters to watch out for Uncle Bill when he's had a few drinks than to report him to the police for being a sex offender. Who wants to bring the pressure and stress of creating schisms in the family, the disruption of police investigations, and the judgment of the neighbours? Even today, when we're seeing an endless stream of well-loved television personalities being called to account for serial sexual offences, there is a type of cognitive dissonance that stops us from considering the bad boy relationship between many pop icons and their teenage groupies. Erzsébet Báthory might have been a harsh mistress and a sadist predator, but she represented some 17 villages at one time. She came from an extremely illustrious aristocratic family. There was much pride in both her aesthetic appearance, she was considered quite beautiful by contemporary accounts during her youth, and her exceptional intelligence and learning. She not only spoke four languages fluently, but read broadly, wrote very well, and was even actively involved in the medical care of her subjects. With the tortures and murders going on out of sight, and often within the confines of the castle, it's not difficult to see a society that mainly accepted that indulged hedonistic aristocrats are gonna, well, hedonist. As self-protection education gets more sophisticated, we need to consider more the various different ways insidious assaults happen. When it comes to being switched on, we need to expand our view to not just walking down a street or into a public space. We need to consider an awareness of our community and the social dynamics of our society. Where do we draw our boundaries? Where do we need to reset them? How do we create a safer space that does not tolerate predatory behaviour? If there ever was an episode that exemplified the phrase going medieval, the crimes and sentencing of this particular case is a hot contender for that position. For an in-depth and meticulously researched discussion on Countess Báthory, I urge you to read Tony Thorne's Countess Dracula and Kimberly Elcraft's Infamous Lady, the true story of Countess Erzsébet Báthory and the private letters of Erzsébet Báthory. These works have done well to debunk much of the mythology that has built up around Erzsébet since her arrest, including the blood-bathing stories immortalised first by Laszlo Tyrici. Thorne's position is somewhat centre towards Báthory being part persecuted and part just a little worse than her contemporaries. Kraft is more towards Team Countess. No Blood in the Water, the legal and gender conspiracies against Countess Elizabeth Báthory in historical context, is a thesis by Rachel Lee Bledshaw for Illinois State University. The abstract reveals that many of the conspiracy theories regarding Báthory being set up or persecuted comes through a Western European lens. It's interesting to note that just as we might cite xenophobia in both the sensationalist French tradition of retelling the Báthory story and blame writers from Lord Byron to Bram Stoker for expressing xenophobic fears of the East in the way that they have helped construct the popular image of fantasy vampires, we see Western-minded assumptions in the defensive arguments for the Countess. Bledshaw's thesis sets out to debunk the theory that Erzsébet's prosecution was an attack by the patriarchy, was for a land grab, or that the trial was unfair for the time. Primary source research shows that early modern Hungary did not view wealthy widows as a threat, that Báthory possessed little of her previous power when she was arrested, and as terrible and fallible as the idea of obtaining confessions under torture seems to us, the interrogations were conducted in a standard manner. We might add that what property Erzsébet did possess was successfully inherited by her descendants, primarily her son, and was still being sold off by him decades later. Debates over the Blood Countess continue as more research is made. Were her crimes exaggerated? Was she no worse than her contemporaries, especially her exceptionally cruel family members such as her maternal grandfather, her uncle and her husband? Or is the fact that her crimes were considered so infamous in her time actual proof of her infamy? If there was a form of conspiracy between Terzo and the king, why did it need to be an elaborate mass murder case and not some straightforward sorcery charges? Erzsébet was neither the first nor last person to torture and murder her servants en masse, to the point that it outraged the people of their time. In 1534, over half a century before these crimes came to public attention, Katerina of Komarov, a Czech noblewoman, was found guilty of torturing and murdering 14 to 30 of her servants. Bearing some similarities to the Báthory case, she apparently committed her crimes whilst administering the estate whilst her husband was away for lengthy periods, and her sentence was to be imprisoned for life in Prague Castle. However, unlike the Countess, this was no house arrest. She was to starve to death. Centuries later, Madame Delphine Lalaurie would provide New Orleans with her own horrific tourist attraction and one of the most terrible examples of crimes committed on slaves. During her time living at the plantation, she was responsible for the systematic torture and murder of countless slaves in her charge. Lalaurie would escape conviction and lynching after she fled a mob uprising that saw her mansion burned to the ground. She died in exile living in Paris. The aforementioned historian, Tony Thorne, states that we know little of Fitzko other than his name. He recounts that Valentine Penrose, in her dreamlike and highly romanticised account of the Bathory story, The Bloody Countess, described him as, quote, a kind of idiot hunchback gnome, very vicious, but at the same time docile, end quote. There is no mention in the court documentation that Fitzko had any obvious visible deformities or is especially small. Thorne describes that historians, such as the author of Biographie Universelle in 1843, who changed the name to mean court dwarf, had speculated on the Fitzko moniker. They asked, why would an adult be described in such a way? The answer seems to me that he was either still an adolescent or only just considered to be an adult. Terzo referred to Fitzko's youth in the sentencing. The Palatine also calls him a young lad in a letter he wrote to his wife, and the local Lutheran pastor who denounced Bathory called him a young man. It doesn't seem to be much of a mystery here. The Countess and her accomplished servants may have regarded him as a plaything, but again, that would be an age issue. Thorne states, quote, just as Elizabeth herself seems to have provided a character for Gothic romances, Fitzko may be a precursor of a stock figure still to be seen in debased form in cartoons and video games, the evil and misshapen retainer. End quote. Perhaps most recognisable of these misshapen stock characters is Dr. Frankenstein's impish assistant Igor. Igor is a composite character that has no equivalent in Mary Shelley's novel. However, his various fictional prototypes, archetypes, and clones are all manifestations of something that exists in the human psyche. Hindu tradition has Ashtavakra, the wise sage and advisor born with eight deformities, and the Krishna-loving Trivakra. But it also has the evil Igor-like hunchbacked maid, Manthara, who plotted and manipulated Queen Kayeki to force the king, Dasaratha, to exile Lord Rama. What can Igor tell us about human behaviour and how we see the world? More importantly, how might this inform our self-protection education? Just as other fantastical horror icons like the vampire or Frankenstein's monster provide rich sources of metaphor to help relay factual ideas, so Igor has plenty to tell us about certain aspects of criminality and being a victim in an oppressive relationship. Fitzko, if we are to believe his confession, was taken by force from his student mother. Presumably the description he gave her meant she worked for the Countess. Taken on his word, or at least the word of the scribe who clearly did not transcribe these testimonies verbatim, we can draw two self-protection points here. Firstly, we have an individual growing up in an education of violence and cruelty who went on to commit acts of violence and cruelty. This is something used to mitigate or at least explain his mistress's own offences. When teaching self-protection, an important idea to impart to students is that often an attacker, be they committing an act of social or asocial violence, will likely come from a totally different background than their victim. This background and culture is likely to have exposed the offender to violence on a regular basis, giving them an education that you or I won't be able to relate to very well. Individuals nurtured in violence learn to use it as a means for expression or to get what they want. Secondly, we can see that an Igor has crossover with my podcast's Convinced Little Man. In that show, we talked about peer pressure and how certain individuals might be convinced to commit heinous acts by figures they respect and revere. In the Jack the Ripper drama, from where I took the line as the podcast's title, a fictionalized version of the coachman John Netley is the titular little man, convinced by Dr. William Gull to aid him in procuring prostitutes to be murdered. It might be argued that Netley is a type of Igor. As my episode Pinocchio's Valentine and the Handshake Hit describes, there are plenty of examples of Igor types who procure victims for the authority figure in their life. At times, Igor is a sycophant, committing terrible acts to please his or her master. In other examples, Igor is a manipulator and the real power behind the throne. Both roles have been suggested for Fitzko, with some people stating Erzsébet blamed her accomplices for bullying her into committing these terrible crimes. This is a topic we will cover, amongst others, in our next chapter, where we will begin with perhaps someone who might be considered to be somewhat of an Igor ancestor. This is another historical character that has been characterised and dramatised first as an evil and misshapen retainer. However, he claimed a position the likes of servants like Fitzko could only dream. This was a character that turned up in two of William Shakespeare's plays and was in existence at least on the page almost 20 years before Fitzko's arrest. Like Fitzko's employer, there are competing sides regarding the extent of the real historical figure's guilt. There is clearly a fictionalised caricature of this man, exaggerating both his physical deformities and his malevolence to some degree, feeding into society's irrational beauty bias. However, unlike Fitzko, whose later incarnations through French literature appear to be shaped in the Igor prototype, this individual's caricature might actually be the main influence for the very idea. I am, of course, discussing Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the man who became Richard III. My other books, Wrong Fu and Mordred's Victory and Other Martial Mutterings, are also available through Amazon as both ebooks and paperbacks, and I'm also selling signed copies. These works are collections of rewritten and re-edited essays I've produced over the last two decades. Wrong Fu is a prequel to my Bull Shih Tzu and the Fight to Make Martial Arts Work project, which deals with critical thinking in the history of martial arts. Mordred's Victory and Other Martial Mutterings covers the 10 years I ran Club Chimera Martial Arts as a school. Nowadays, I teach private lessons, courses and seminars. These are bespoke services that put you in charge of your martial arts journey. I teach self-protection and martial arts cross-training. You can train with me one-to-one or in a small group. I count individual clients, couple clients, parent and child clients, and various other combinations. These can be taught face-to-face or virtually. I also regularly teach clubs, societies and associations nationally and internationally. Please go to clubchimera.com for details. Please don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Owltale, or whatever podcast platform you're currently using. If you could leave me a 5-star rating and a review, I would be really grateful. You can also follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and at long last, TikTok. Facebook also has a members group in addition to the main business page, so please send in a request to join in with the training discussions and be a part of the wider CCMA community. I'm also uploading new content to YouTube. There are various short videos, vlogs, and full video versions of some of these podcast episodes on there, as well as filming of my various lessons. So you get an idea of the different services that I provide. Please check out the services section on the YouTube channel to find out more details on these individual services and suggestions for where you might want to take your training with me. Again, please subscribe, like, share, and leave a comment. All favourable engagement on these platforms helps keep CCMA going. Now, I don't know where you listen to this show, or watch or read any of the other free content I produce. My time to listen to podcasts usually occurs during dog walks or solo car journeys, or when I'm undertaking some mundane task or other around my home. I watch videos when I'm in the kitchen. My reading time occurs when I'm in a waiting room or during a rest period at home. My guess is a good number of you will think nothing of buying a coffee or some other beverage when you're commuting or waiting or on your break. If you believe that the work I produce is worth the price of a coffee, then please click on support the show in this episode's show notes. Whether or not you choose to do this, my thanks to everyone who joins me on this Vagabond Warrior's journey, and I look forward to sharing more travel notes with you all on the next show.